which itself is riddled with corruption and imbalance, leaving the system free to reign havoc as it does not have a legal constitution nor a system of state governance. With Netanyahu heading yet another delicate coalition, haphazardly welded together by branches of far-right ultra-Zionist groups, the move would see him only answerable to the people he put in power, thus nullifying any legal obligations or pressures against him. Thousands of disgruntled marchers have taken to the streets to show their discontent over the reform of the law. The diaspora of protesters has been large and wide, with promoted rallies and demonstrations taking part not only in Tel Aviv but across the whole of the occupying territory from Haifa to Eilat and from Netanya to Jerusalem. As well as rallies and protests in the streets, which has seen Israeli security forces turn against their own people, a host of professions have joined the waves of discontented people. Medical professionals staged a walkout following the passing of the law, briefly upsetting the medical world and putting patients and healthcare plans at risk. But more worryingly for the hyper-paranoid, security-conscious regime leader, the fact that military forces are also threatening to stop volunteering the duties could be the straw that breaks Netanyahu's back in keeping him in power. The regime relies heavily on its so-called voluntary army of reservists to maintain its security. Its relatively small professional army is backed up heavily by the 462,000 reservists that remain on call, who boost numbers for up to 60 days a year, even during rare times of peace. Over 10,000 reservists have signed an open petition saying they demand to be released from service should Netanyahu's plans be passed through legislation, something that eventually happened in the Knesset with a 64-to-none vote. It now remains to be seen whether the volunteers will adhere to their threat and leave Netanyahu's security apparatus exposed to yet more pressure, both internally and potentially from outside. Outside of those protesting and threatening to boycott their positions comes another headache for the despotic leader. The financial impact being seen is taking its toll on a country which already struggles with financial power, as the stock exchange plummeted some 5% since the news of the law changes was announced. The disputed law is also being criticised by some of the Israeli regime's greatest foreign allies too. The US, UK and France, as well as a host of Jewish groups, have all expressed alarm about the judicial legislation and the fissures it has opened within the regime, and urged compromise, something once again downplayed by the narcissist ego of Netanyahu, who stated his relationship with allies is very strong. However, the White House warned the Israeli regime not to rush the process of passing through the legislation, something of a rare intervention by Washington, but one that shows clear cracks in ties between the two allies. It is not just the allies of the Israeli regime that have stood and watched the protests in alarm and condemned the action of Netanyahu. Leader of Hezbollah, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, speaking of the events currently happening inside the occupying regime's corridors, told the supporters of the group that the Israeli regime is on the path of collapse, fragmentation and disappearance. With Netanyahu seemingly overcome with the stress and strains of the situation he faces, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani also used the situation to take a jibe at the Israeli regime leader, stating that the crisis in Israel matches the crisis in his heart. With the Knesset now dissolved for a summer recess, the pressure on Netanyahu is still high as protesters vow to continue their opposition to the controversial law. The Israeli regime, already weakened politically as demonstrated by endless elections, stalemates and infighting, must now wait and watch for the reaction of the people as the law comes into play. With Netanyahu seeking to distract his critics over his past corruption, the implementation of the law has further cemented the notion that the Israel's dictator is becoming ever more desperate to hold on to power at any cost. Yet for the people of Israel, the emperor's new clothes are more see-through than ever as people rise up against the man they clearly can no longer stand. And these are the Israeli protests in a nutshell. The BRICS group of emerging economic powers. The alliance was initially formed in 2006 by Russia, China, India, and Brazil, and was joined 4 years later by South Africa. Representing 40% of the world's population and a quarter of global economy, the member nations have gone on a quest for a multipolar world order in which no single power dominates. Let's take a look at BRICS, its missions, and how it's going in a nutshell. Over the past years, BRICS has been challenging some of the key elements of the United States unilateralism. More recently, the members have been mulling over expansion, something that would contribute to its efforts to emerge as a counterweight to Western coalitions such as G7. Actually, during this year's summit, the member nations took some effective steps toward that goal by taking in Iran and Saudi Arabia, two of the world's largest oil producers, along with some other states. The acronym was originally BRIC, the initial letters of the names of Brazil, Russia, India, and China. It was coined in 2001 by a Goldman Sachs analyst who wrote a paper on emerging economies. Jim O'Neill said back then that the foursome had GDP growth that would exceed that of G7 countries. That notion really came to life in 2006, when the quartet formed an informal group of allies to contribute to the world economy and gain a greater role in the global market, which was then dominated by the US. In 2010, South Africa also joined, and the acronym became BRICS. The group has set as its goal reshaping the world's political-economic landscape. To promote that agenda, it has set up different institutions such as Business Council, the Contingent Reserve Agreement, which provides short-term liquidity support, and the New Development Bank, which supports development projects in BRICS and is envisioned as an alternative to the Washington-based World Bank. For a long period of time, the G7, consisting of the US, Canada, the UK, Germany, France, Italy, and Japan, used to hold sway over the global economy and its management. But the rise of BRICS and the rapid economic development of its nations are beginning to shatter that dominance. The five BRICS nations managed to surpass the G7 in terms of their combined GDP in 2020. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, says the alliance will altogether account for 32.1% of global GDP in 2023, up from a mere 16.9% in 1995, and more than the G7's share of 29.9%. BRICS thus accounts for 41% of the world's population, over 32% of global gross domestic product, and 16% of global trade. Observers believe the group's formidable standing on the world's economic stage gives it a lot of bargaining power if the member nations act together, something they appear to be doing increasingly. In the meantime, there's been growing interest in joining the bloc, which is already a major territorial and demographic bloc. At this year's summit, the BRICS members just widened the family. The bloc agreed during a meeting on Friday to admit Iran, Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, Egypt, Argentina, and the United Arab Emirates. Iran, which also possesses the world's second largest gas reserves, had applied to join BRICS in June as part of its efforts to strengthen economic and political ties with non-Western aligned countries and neighbors, a central plank of President Ibrahim Raisi's foreign policy. As many as 40 states are said to be seeking accession to the group. If BRICS accepts such states as Cuba and Venezuela besides Iran, it will likely strengthen its anti-US positioning, especially at a time that it's been pushing ahead with a de-dollarization campaign to rid the US of its sanctions tool against other countries. There are, however, disagreements among member nations on how to expand the bloc and how to proceed. It now remains to be seen what course of action will be taken to fulfill the dream of a multipolar world with a diverse economy. This was a look at BRICS, its missions, and how it's going in a nutshell. On July the 26th, Nigerians woke up to a military takeover of the capital. Soldiers were out of the barracks in the presidential palace and government ministries in Niamey. President Mohamed Bazoum, his wife and his son had been confined to the palace and staff had been prevented from entering. Here's a look at the military takeover in Niger in a nutshell. Shortly afterwards, Presidential Guard Commander Abdul Rahman Chiani declared himself the head of a new military government, which he called the National Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland. In a matter of hours, Niger's history had turned a chapter and the country had joined a group of cross-Africa states that had seen coups only recently. Niger was a former French colony. It declared independence from France in 1960. And since then, there have been five coups, the last one being the one in July. Anti-colonial and anti-French sentiments run high among Nigerians. And those opposing Western influence tend to favor an alliance with Russia instead. In fact, the National Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland has promoted the Russian paramilitary group Wagner's activities against local terrorist groups in the Sahel region, mainly in Mali and Burkina Faso, following coups in both of those countries and at the expense of France. France has purported to intend to fight terrorism in, not surprisingly, many of its former colonies. In Niger, it has had 1,500 troops, and there are at least 1,100 US troops in the country, as well as a secret CIA base. Nothing about the presence of the foreigners has impressed Nigerians, however. Following the military takeover, there have been several protests against foreign influence, with some of the demonstrators holding Russian flags. Chiani himself has blamed the government's alleged failure to fight terrorism. Bazoum, he has said, hit the harsh reality in the country of a pile of dead, displaced, humiliation and frustration. And he has refused to back down despite mounting pressure, not just from France and the US, but also from a bloc of African countries known as Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. Following the putsch, the disturbed ECOWAS gave Chiani 7 days to retreat to the barracks and free President Bazoum. That deadline was ignored, and the bloc, though belatedly, activated its standby force, threatening to invade Niger to reinstate Bazoum and his government. That threat hangs in the balance as a meeting of defense chiefs from the bloc was cancelled indefinitely for technical reasons, according to reports. Meanwhile, juntas in Mali and Burkina Faso have said any intervention in Niger would be a declaration of war on them too. France had concentrated its purported anti-terrorism operation in Sahel in Mali, another former French colony, until the junta leaders in that country chose to partner with Wagner, the Russian paramilitary group, instead, and led Paris to reposition its efforts to Niger. But anti-French sentiments in Niger have been no less strong. In August, France began evacuating its and other European citizens from Niger amid reinforced anti-colonial furore. Planes were sent in with coordination because the military leaders had closed the country's airspace. Earlier, protesters outside the French embassy in Niamey set fire to the exterior walls of the premises. They shouted, "Long live Russia, long live Putin, and down with France," leaving no doubts about their preferences for partnership. But it hasn't been all hostility. Days after the takeover, Chad's president, Mohamed Idriss Deby, travelled to Niamey to mediate on behalf of ECOWAS. He was even allowed to meet with Bazoum. That diplomatic effort came on the auspices of ECOWAS chair and Nigerian president, Bola Tinubu, even as the bloc threatened military force. The military leaders are refusing to back down, while ECOWAS seems to be undecided about an actual invasion. If any such military intervention takes place, what precedents would it set for nations that dare to question a Western-friendly status quo? What remains to be seen is whether the Nigerian nation, with its long history of colonial rule and oppression, opts for more of the same or a different path. Where each of those choices would take the country are unknown as well, but it's up to the Nigerian people to decide anyway. This was a look at the military takeover in Niger in a nutshell.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
And
closely watched gauge of long-term inflation expectations in the Eurozone reached its highest level since 2010, in a sign that some investors think the European Central Bank, the ECB, will struggle to bring inflation back to its 2% target range. We've taken a look at some of the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Sputnik news agency has covered this story and tells us more. More dismal news from the European continent showed that slackening economic growth and lingering inflation are raising the specter of stagflation for countries of the Eurozone. Despite the aggressive monetary policy of the European Central Bank, the ECB, aimed at curbing inflation, the consumer price inflation CPI rate in the euro area was at 5.3% in July. In fact, inflation has remained above the ECB's target of 2% for around 26 consecutive months. In none of the Eurozone's 20 member countries has it reached that level yet. Yet again, the largest contributor has been food inflation, rising 9.8% from a year earlier on average. Energy costs soared 3.2% in August from the previous month across the euro currency area. Core inflation at 5.3% was down from 5.5% in July. Core HICP inflation is defined as year-on-year percentage change in the euro area special aggregate, all items excluding energy, food, drinks and tobacco, as per Eurostat, the statistical office of the European Union. Data from Eurostat showed that the number of unemployed people in the Eurozone rose 73,000 in July compared to June. According to Eurostat, when broken down by country, in France the annual rate of inflation grew to 5.7%. In Germany, inflation was at 6.4% in August. Europe's largest economy has been in a recession for three straight quarters. While all of the Eurozone plunged into a technical recession in June, it was the industrialized German economy that was hit particularly hard in the wake of the bloc's self-inflicted woes linked to sanctions against Russia over Ukraine. Crippled by the loss of cheap Russian natural gas along with inflation and recession, Berlin has been facing the prospect of deindustrialization as doing business in Germany becomes unprofitable. The Federal Statistical Office in Germany, the DStatis, on Thursday, 31st of August, showed German retail sales were down even more than expected in July, plunging 0.8% compared to the previous month. With all this data in mind, the European Central Bank is gearing up for its meeting on 14th of September, where interest rate settings may be revisited again. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The European Central Bank, the ECB, raised the benchmark interest rate in the euro area for a ninth consecutive hike by a quarter of a percentage point in July. However, at the time it indicated it could pause hikes at its 14th of September meeting at 3.75%, it echoed the highest rate since the launch of the bloc's currency, the euro, in 1999. The president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, said in July, "We might hike and we might hold, and what is decided in September is not definitive. It may vary from one meeting to the other." According to minutes of that July meeting, released on Thursday, 31st of August, it was stated that concern was also raised that the economy might be entering a phase of stagflation, in contrast to a more benign scenario. In late August, appearing at an annual conference for central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, United States, the president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, said that interest rates in the European Union will stay high as long as necessary to tame inflation, adding that while progress is being made, the fight against inflation is not yet won. Ahead of the release of the Eurostat data on Thursday, Isabel Schnabel, a member of the European Central Bank's executive board, was cited as saying that underlying price pressures remain stubbornly high, with domestic factors now being the main drivers of inflation in the euro area. She added, "A sufficiently restrictive policy was called for to bring inflation to the bank's 2% target range in a timely manner." Countries on the European continent found themselves bearing the fallout from NATO proxy confrontation against Russia in Ukraine when they opted to follow in Washington's footsteps and voluntarily strip themselves of access to Russian energy. Germany and other European economies were, as a result, driven into a recession in 2022 after moving to reject Russian oil and gas purchases. Moscow had warned at the time that the move would result in a catastrophic loss in competitiveness among German industry. The president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, did not mince her words on 25th of August at the Central Bank Symposium in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, saying the economic downturn facing most Western economies will likely continue. According to Lagarde, the world may be entering an age of shifts in economic relationships and breaks in established regularities. Juggling data and expert forecasts, economists tend to agree with that gloomy prediction. The website This Is Money has also covered the same story and tells us more. French households are facing higher prices and inflation climbed more than expected in August, driven by soaring energy bills. France, the European Union's second largest economy after Germany, recorded a 12-month inflation rate of 5.7% last month, up from 5.1% in July. Analysts had predicted a lower interest rate in August, with a poll of 18 economists conducted by Reuters news agency forecasting a rate of 5.4%. The only good news was that food inflation was 11.1% in August from 12.7% in July, but that was still almost twice the overall inflation rate. Energy prices, which fell 3.7% in July, rose 6.8%. The EU Statistics Agency said this rise is due to a rebound in energy prices, food prices eased, as well as manufactured products and services. According to the agency, Eurozone core inflation was unchanged at 5.3% in the year to August. Also, Germany's economy stagnated in the second quarter from the previous 3 months, showing no sign of recovery from a winter recession and cementing its position as one of the world's weakest major economies. The figure of zero growth rate for the second quarter of this year was in line with a first estimate published in late July. Year-on-year, adjusted gross domestic product contracted by 0.2% in the second quarter of this year. Quarter-on-quarter, economic activity had fallen by 0.4% in the fourth quarter of 2022 and by 0.1% in the first quarter of 2023. Two consecutive quarters of contraction fulfills the technical definition of a recession. Carsten Brzeski, a global head of macro at ING Bank, said both the short-term and the longer-term outlook for Germany looks anything but rosy. Brzeski said weak purchasing power thinned out industrial order books, a slowdown in the Chinese economy, and the impact of the most aggressive monetary policy tightening in decades all point to weak economic activity in Germany going forward. Household consumption showed zero growth in the second quarter of this year compared to the first, and government spending rose by 0.1%. Recent data showed capital investment also grew modestly, while exports fell 1.1%. Pantheon Macroeconomics forecasts Gross domestic product will post a 0.2% contraction in the third quarter of this year before a rebound of 0.4% quarter-on-quarter in the last quarter of this year.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Back to Reality. Well, I am Asma. I have the honor to be your host for today's episode, and as for the guests, we have two very dear ones, Sister Bita and Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, sisters, and welcome to the studio.
Walaikum assalam. Thank you for having us.
And thank you for being here. Well, let's just start with Sister Bita.
Yeah.
Shall you please introduce yourself?
For sure. Assalamu alaikum. I am Bita and I'm studying medicine at one of the universities in Tehran. And again, I'm really happy that I have the chance and honor to be here with you too.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for having me. I am Zainab Askari and I am actually from Kashmir. I am done with my master's in linguistics and I have been living in Iran for some 9 years.
So wish you luck, guys, and thank you for being here. It's just honestly a great honor for me. So, previously in Back to Reality, we've been talking about how to be ourselves, how to keep it just the way it is, how to be changed, but not for the benefit of others, for just the mere fact of changing without thinking about it or without being aware of it. And I guess there's a lot more to talk about when it comes to changes in this modern world.
You know, I think there is this interesting fact that besides fact that people think that they're not changing, they are changing more than in the past, you know.
Exactly.
You know, they are saying that, okay, no, I'm not going to change, but they are changing. You know, I think the underlying reason for this phenomenon that is happening is that when you go through the social media, you are changing the pages, the people that, you know, have a lot of things in common with you. So when you're following the pages that, you know, they do agree with whatever you think, you feel like you're not changing, you know, because maybe about 70% of whatever they are telling is exactly what you think about life. But when you go deep in this actually phenomenon, you will understand that this 30% or 20% of whatever they are telling or not or acting or whatever is exactly the opposite of what you think or what you are. And this 20% has a strong effect on you and you cannot understand it consciously.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, the problem.
It will get in on
exactly
your skin.
And
yeah,
I think this is the problem with social media, is that you feel like you're not changing, but actually these social medias are, you know, have their hands in each other to change you completely from one person to another one.
Yeah,
this is my opinion.
We should be open to changes. I know the world around us is changing at a very, very drastic speed without like the fact we can even imagine it. But I think we should be open to change. Like, for example, I'll say I love to write letters and I love to only convey to people around with that writing system.
Yeah.
But that's now a traditional system. Now you have something you can do at a very fast pace. So sometimes I have to take that influence and I have to change with the time. Sometimes it could save my time. And yes, I could use traditional methods for sometimes to, you know, keep that beauty of that thing alive.
Yeah.
But I should not be used to that particular thing. Sometimes taking influence is very, very important. Like, it could expand our horizons. It could impact us positively.
It would help us improve, actually.
Exactly. We have experiences. We learn mm-hmm. around. But again, I would say, as we discuss in many of the episodes, moderation, keeping a balance. That's
exactly.
A key thing.
But that moderation in this modern world is such a very drudgery.
That's a struggle.
Yeah.
Really have to struggle. Learn that.
It's a battle, I would say. Every day we're in a battlefield, and then there's something else.
We're taking most of the influences, as Sister Beta said, from the social media as well. I would say it's bad to take influence from there. Like, these platforms have got a tremendous potential to increase our knowledge.
Exactly.
So what is important to, I think media literacy is important.
Yeah,
this is, we should be educating ourselves.
Exactly.
But at the same time, not taking any influence or not changing with time is also not correct. So moderation is actually
key. Yeah, moderation is the key fact. Well, as you just said, when we say that we get influenced by other factors, by other people easily, it's not always for bad. Sometimes it's good to be affected by some people who are very good and very successful.
Like, take the religious sermons. You listen to a religious scholar in the, like, in Muharram Majalis, or like in Ramadan, or anytime else. It could really expand your worldview.
Exactly. So before we get into more of that, let's go for a short break and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Yeah, sometimes it's really good to get the influence from the other people and change with their charismatic personality or with whatever they're doing, because sometimes some changes that come from the external world is going to improve you and develop you into this best version of yourself. So this is still Back to Reality. I'm Asma. Sister Zainab and Sister Beta are with us in here, and we're talking about the changes that might happen to us throughout our lifetime. Well, it's not always bad to get changed. And we already have talked about it, that we have it in history, we have it in our religion, that some people meet a person and then that person would change their life drastically. Like, to get changed through good qualities.
You know, there are, I think, some examinations in everybody's life, some difficulties, some disasters, I can say, that they happen in our lives. For example, losing some beloved persons in our lives. Just having a disease which is not curable. These are, I think, all the examinations that will lead to a big change in you.
The thing that happens in your mind for the very first moment that you understand that you have an incurable disease, then it's just a moment of a shock.
It is.
And that shock is going to change you totally.
And I cannot imagine just being in that situation.
Exactly.
You know, it's really scary.
Yeah, just imagine, when I just think about it, just imagining myself that I'm in the verge of a big, big, big change.
Yeah.
Like, I would not have enough of time for living. So that's going to
harsh. The thing which matters here is the fear that you feel like you have a limited time, you have to do something.
Exactly.
This course is the reason. Also, this fear can work exactly in the other way. Like, for example, you fear changing.
The key point again here is this, you know, balance. Even like Islam does not tell us, like, no, don't listen to anything. Islam says that, you know, it says in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Holy Quran, Allazina yastami'una al-qawl fayattabi'una ahsana. Listen to what is being said, but follow the best of it.
Exactly.
So,
try to pick out the best one.
Exactly. So Islam does not tell, like, you know, do not just keep yourself open to get influenced by the things. It tells you, be mindful and select the best
of
it. Follow the best of it. The key is to strike a balance between being open to a positive influence taken from different sources. Like, it could be, as I said, it could be religious scholars. I just remember I was listening to one of the speeches of, Dr. Rafi, who is very, very famous religious scholar. And he was saying that there was a girl who came to him and she was thanking him like anything. And she was saying that this life of mine is just because of you. I was just about to finish my life. I was trying to commit a suicide, but the TV was on, and within no time, it was like, I don't know how your speech came about suicide, that suicide is haram. I never knew that suicide was haram. So, you know, it could actually guide you. Sometimes there are some things like these religious scholars, they could guide you, they can open your viewpoint on different things. There are many sermons or there are many books, there are many stories that could influence you, but take positive influence.
Exactly.
That's very
just
important.
Even in media, there are some changes that are happening into good. If you follow them, they would actually give your life an instruction, they would give you arrangement and discipline, but then... there are some other parts about media that would change your life into the worst ever and possible format. So let's talk about this after the break. And yes, thank you for staying tuned. Yes, this is the last part of today's episode. We still are talking about the changes that might happen to us. Some of them are into good, some of them are not. We said that the key point is just to be aware of it, what's going on, and then have it in mind. The moderation is very important.
Yeah.
As we can see, in past, people were not that much attracted into gaining too much of money or, I don't know, buying new dresses or anything like that. But right now, as if there's a bombardment into their brain. Like, you feel like, I have to.
Yeah.
There is a competition and I should get into it. There is no way for me to just hold myself back.
You know what I think? As you know, this is mocked reality and reality is bitter always. And I think the reality of this modern world is that priorities are changing.
Exactly.
Unfortunately. And right now, in this modern world, just materialistic things like money, luxury things, luxury life, I don't know, the more you have, the better you are. Unfortunately,
exactly.
This is the priority of most of the people.
Yeah.
And this is the value. And when it becomes to something a value, it's really difficult to change it. And, you know, I think at the end, this is something common in the society. You can see people that they have more money and they feel proud of themselves. And the self-satisfaction they gain by this money is really high that you think they may be true. But you have to just keep that in mind. At the end, this is the religion. That is the right way and the right path you have to follow. And this materialistic world is going to end here. You know,
yeah, exactly.
There is an afterlife. There is, I don't know, something there for you. And
there is
maybe,
something beyond
yeah,
our
exactly.
materialistic life. And
maybe
we should take care of it.
Just 10% of whatever we are is about this materialistic
yeah.
world. There is something more. And just we have to go for this mm-hmm. something more because we deserve it.
Exactly. So since so I think, up, there has always been aristocracy in this world. And there has been always these kind of people who were not a part of that aristocratic life.
Right.
But then right now, the thing which has changed is the bombardment. You feel like you have been brought up into the middle of a competition that you don't even want to.
Bombardment should be answered with bombardment. I think I should, in this world of bombardment, I should bombard myself with knowledge. I think you should equip yourself with Islamic knowledge, Islamic guidance.
Exactly.
That could actually help you to face the bombardment. I think in every case, especially in this case of, you know, getting influenced so much from the materialistic world, is to have a personal reflection, regular introspection is extremely necessary and self-awareness. My father did this very beautiful thing. He gifted us small diaries to all the sisters mm-hmm. and said, "Well, at night, when you go to sleep, go for a regular introspection and write the good things.
Soul searching thing.
Right. Do the good things. Make two columns. Write good things, what you did. Write bad things. Ask for forgiveness for the bad things. Thank Allah for the good things. And may ask Him for the strength." So, you know, I think this regular introspection is the key point. It's really necessary.
Not to lose yourself
exactly.
in the crowd.
Exactly. You could, you are open to changes at the same time and you're yourself at the same time. But if introspection and self-awareness is not there and you're not mindful of what's happening around, then you could go away with the wind, you know, you could go away with the way whatever is happening
exactly.
around.
Exactly.
And equip yourself with Islamic knowledge.
Exactly. And knowledge always would just flourish the best of you. So you have to go for it every now and then.
And these influences or all these changes should be taken, I think, to convert yourself into the best version of yourself.
Exactly, yeah. To just give the very gist, I would say that change has got two aspects. One is good and the other one is not good. If you are going to change into a better you, then it's very good. The crowd you have picked is very good for you. The media that you're following is good for you. If it's bringing the best out of you. But then if not, it's changing you into this very devilish sort of a person, into this materialistic person who gets so much engaged in all this materialistic stuff, then I guess you have to think about it twice. So yeah, thank you for staying with us in today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you, Sister Zainab, and thank you, Sister Bita.
Thank you.
Well, this was all. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك Let us see daylight again, once again.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, new National Health Service figures revealed that more than 1 million patients in England have experienced a delay in their cancer care since Prime Minister Rishi Sunak took office 11 months ago. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. The UK's Labour Party said patients across England waited for a total of more than 5.4 million hours in accidents and emergency departments while experiencing a mental health crisis last year. According to the Labour Party, figures obtained through Freedom of Information requests showed that last year, one patient in Ridington, Wigan and Lee NHS Foundation Trust waited in accidents and emergency department for 860 hours, the equivalent of 36 days, while suffering a mental health crisis. Another patient at University Hospital in Southampton, NHS Foundation Trust, waited 496 hours, equivalent to 21 days. And a third at Epsom and St Helier University Hospital, NHS Trust, waited 278 hours, or the equivalent of 12 days. The Labour Party said among child patients, James Paget University Hospital NHS Foundation Trust in Norfolk had the longest wait of 208 hours, or 9 days, followed by University Hospital Southampton at 198 hours, and Epsom and St Helier at 150 hours. Shadow Mental Health Minister Rosanna Alim-Khan said, "These long, inappropriate waits in accidents and emergency are shocking. Patients have borne the brunt of the Conservative government's failure to bring down waiting lists within the NHS. Rosanna Alim-Khan said, "The government should focus on improving services for patients. Instead, they have scrapped their 10-year mental health plan and are dragging their feet on reforming the Mental Health Act." She added, "Labour stands ready with a plan to recruit 8,500 additional mental health staff to drive down waiting lists funded through closing tax loopholes." The data was obtained through Freedom of Information requests directed at NHS Acute Trusts. The party gathered information about the longest waiting times for adult and child mental health patients since 2010, as well as a total duration patients spent waiting in accidents and emergency departments during the financial year 2022-2023. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. New National Health Service figures revealed more than 1 million patients in England have experienced a delay in their cancer care since Prime Minister Rishi Sunak took office 11 months ago. Analysis by the House of Commons Library of Official Waiting Time Performance data shows that huge numbers of people with suspected or confirmed cancer have not been able to see a specialist for the first time, getting a diagnosis or start treatment within NHS target times since last October. For example, between October of last year and June of this year, 418,412 people had to wait longer for their first appointment with an oncologist after being urgently referred by a GP than the 2-week supposed maximum. The Labour Party, which commissioned the analysis, said an even larger number, 623,676, either did not receive a diagnosis of cancer or were not told that they were clear of the disease within 28 days after their referral during those months. That equates to 3 in 10 of all suspected cancer patients. The library's research also confirmed what cancer charities had been highlighting for some time, that most of the NHS's existing 9 cancer performance targets have not been met for years. Recently, the government and NHS England announced that they are scrapping those measures of performance and replacing them with just 3 successors. Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, said ministers were moving the goalposts because the NHS's long-standing failure to meet key cancer targets had become politically embarrassing. The move had divided opinion among cancer charities. Cancer Research UK has welcomed the switch. It believes the new emphasis being put on everyone suspected of having cancer receiving a diagnosis within 28 days of a GP referral will benefit patients. Macmillan Cancer Support has also given the plans a cautious welcome, saying faster diagnosis should help improve patient outcomes. However, Professor Pat Rice, a leading cancer doctor and co-founder of Catch Up with Cancer campaign, charged the government with watering down long-established targets. Breast Cancer UK also criticised ministers for including breast in a new major condition strategy rather than bringing forward a dedicated plan to tackle the disease and improve services. All the charities urged the National Health Service and ministers to give hard-pressed cancer services more staff and more funding to help overcome delays that have become commonplace, and warned that some people's cancer could become too advanced to be treatable. Steve Barclay, Britain's health secretary, added to the confusion surrounding cancer waiting times by suggesting recently in an interview with the Daily Telegraph that some patients with potential symptoms could bypass their GP and refer themselves directly to a diagnostic centre or specialist doctor. The British Medical Association and the BMA charged Steve Barclay with putting forward a seductively simple plan that could add to the strain on already hard-pressed diagnostic services. British newsletter The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. According to a leading trade union, a survey of new National Health Service workers has revealed shocking levels of staff shortages, which are impacting on British patients' safety. Half of more than 3,000 polled United members working in different roles throughout the National Health Service in England said staffing levels in their area have regularly reached a point where patient care has been compromised and unsafe. In the past year, Unite said the figure for nurses was 3 out of 5. The opinion poll also found in the last 12 months, half of respondents said they have considered leaving the National Health Service, while a further 13% have considered retiring. Unite General Secretary Sharon Graham said the survey's findings are stark. Every day across England, patients are being put in danger due to staff shortages. Sharon Graham added, the current pay offer, in reality a real terms pay cut, has done nothing to address the recruitment and retention crisis that is undermining patient care. Sharon Graham added, rather than tackling the cause of this crisis, the government is missing in action. The survey comes as the union escalates industrial action after its members rejected the government's pay offer. Unite is planning a series of new ballots and re-ballots asking members if they wish to take strike action over pay and the recruitment and retention crisis.
Hidden Files. I grew up in the United States with a counting song that went like this. One little, two little, three little Indians, four little, five little, six little Indians, seven little, eight little, nine little Indians, 10 little Indian boys. Now this was supposed to be a song for kids to learn how to count. And the other part of it is they dive in the boat and the boat turns over, 10 little, 9 little, 8 little Indian boys, and continues. If one thinks about what is being said, it is shocking, but as a kid, I just mimicked the lyrics like the other kids, not realizing the overall effect. I also grew up being shown Indian savages on westerns and how the poor white man just wanted to live in peace and develop the land that he had discovered. But the Redskins would not let them live in peace. This is the other process, meaning dehumanizing people. And these are just two examples of the way the original inhabitants of North America, the natives, were demonized and discounted, even up to this day in what is now the United States. From the time the European colonizers stepped foot on that land, the white man saw the natives as less than themselves. They were less human, less smart, less civilized, less deserving, which led to the invaders being able to forcibly remove and exterminate much of the original population of the land a lot easier. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. Today we will be looking at the original inhabitants of North America, the natives. I am Marzia Hashimi. Welcome. Well, the natives had lived on that land for tens of thousands of years. In 1492, when Columbus actually landed there, there were 112 million indigenous people. 112 million indigenous people. Keep that number in mind, because as we fast forward and we go to 1650, we have gone from that number of 112 million to 6 million people. Imagine that, by 1650. Unfortunately, the tragedy is so multifaceted. We look at then from between 1776 to 1887, and 1.5 billion acres of native land was stolen. This is the story, only part of the tragedy of the natives. Well, from being free to roam and live on over a billion acres to being forced to live on reservations, this became the reality for most natives who didn't die at the hands of the colonizers. Reservations were set up by the whites to control the native population, while at the same time more of their land could be stolen. Harsh measures were implemented, and brainwashing and miseducation were techniques used, as well as the Christianization of the natives on the reservations. Now, the land that the Europeans forced the natives to live on usually was not as fertile as the land they were used to having, or was the type of terrain that they were not familiar with. And many different tribes were thrown together on a reservation, not giving thought to if they were friendly with each other or if the tribe was used to farming or not. We're going to look at the role reservations have played and continue to play in the oppression and attempted elimination of native people with my first guest.
Bleak.
Oppression.
Small.
Small. They're beautiful and sad at the same time. It's beautiful because you're surrounded by people that are just like you. But it's sad because everything that affects big cities, whether it's drugs or alcohol or everything's magnified on a reservation. You see it up front, like in your face.
Sick? You know, there's alcoholism, there's, you know, there's abuse, there's domestic violence. There's a lot of things that go on a reservation that really goes overlooked.
Just a compromise. It was an agreement based, well, forced agreement probably, that Native Americans were put kind of out of the way, out of sight.
Yeah. Prison. It's like where we were trapped.
What is the most common misconception about reservations?
That there's some kind of abundance, that Natives are happy, that they're caring for each other, that they live in some ancient way.
Ooh, sad.
Poor.
A concentration camp. Reservations were made to isolate Indian people and hope that we would die off.
Depressing.
Unfair, because they're not as good as other lands. They're the land that the government and people don't want.
Trapped?
It wasn't great farmland, it wasn't great homeland. And so it kind of feels like a place off to the side.
Even to this day, the natives are fighting for rights to keep the little what they have.
There are no good reservations. Here's your reservation. You can't go across that boundary. This is your reservation. and I grew up on a Navajo reservation, and we're one of the few lucky people that got to remain where our homelands are. But there are other reservations where people were forced there, and they can't fend for themselves like they used to do in the old days. You can't hunt anymore, you can't fish anymore, because you're just stuck on a reservation on these substandard housing, living in third world country conditions. Youths killing themselves because there's no future, there's no hope. That's a reservation to me.
Very sad.